was a still.
Okay. There's a bunch of pictures, and I don't know, does that building look familiar?
No.
It looks pretty impressive. I don't know whether that's in Atascadero.
I say no, I've seen that building, but I don't know where. This creek would indicate it wasn't in this area, but.
Well, yeah, and I'm wondering if it's in Atascadero or something like that.
Possible.
Maybe that is a good thing. This has got Medley Still, Horses in Corral.
Well, Medley Still lived out at the Copapansa. They called it something like Copapansa Station. There's the old stone building is still there.
Right.
And they operated a kind of hotel, boarding house sort of place there. The post office, that was the post office. Yeah, I knew Medley Still. And they, when they hauled grain in from the Carissa place, the only place they could take it to San Luis to get it on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
So they went right past that,
mm-hmm.
dropped down in the Navajo Canyon, and then back over the hill again to Pozo.
Mm-hmm.
And it took them, they stayed one night there at what they referred to as Lepanza, which was where the McLeans, the Stills were.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next night, if they all went well, they were in Pozo, where there was a hotel of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd get a meal there. Yeah.
And then from Pozo to San Luis, was it possible? Was that one day?
I would guess that they had to go to Santa Margarita.
Okay.
Pretty slow. I think a team, 2 miles an hour, mile and three quarters an hour is pretty good clip for a team.
Okay.
They had two wagons, one wagon behind the other.
And what were they, four horse teams? Or?
Oh, no. They would be six, eight, 10 mules.
Okay.
The mules would be in pairs,
mm-hmm.
and they used what was referred to as a jerk line. Usually the teamster usually rode a wheel mule, that's a mule right in front of the wagon,
mm-hmm.
and he controlled the lead mules with the bosses. He controlled them by jerking the line once, twice, or three times,
mm-hmm.
to go right, go left, or stop.
Mm-hmm.
Now, have you been over what I refer to as the old grade from Pozo? Over.
I probably don't know what that
is. It's a road. I'll take you over that someday if you like. It's the original road from the Carissa Plains, left the plains, and up by where the Stills live,
mm-hmm.
dropped down in the Navajo Canyon, came down this way away, then circled back and went up over a lower divide, with lots of tight switchbacks,
mm-hmm.
and then dropped into Pozo.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys had this long line of, say, 8 mules and 2 wagons.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to go around these very tight turns. These guys really had to know what they were doing.
Uh-huh.
But that was the only way they could get in. Then they had to go clear to San Luis, right. where they then could unload onto the narrow gauge. And they would go down to the port.
So then that was abandoned for the present, more or less, the present road.
This road, the 58th, was built at the time of the Second World War.
Oh.
There would have been no way to go, well, you could, if we had wanted to go from here to the Carissa Plains,
okay.
we would have gone up this valley, past where you saw where I pointed out where the Comanche Ranch House was.
Okay.
Then gone up to the canyon from there, and then we would have hit a road which went from Pozo to Lepanza, two grades. And we would have gone over that second grade and dropped down the road, now the Lepanza Ranch,
uh-huh.
and then out.
Uh-huh.
It was quite a track.
Yeah. Okay, well that explains that medley.
When I was first knew it, the people who lived out there were the McLeans. Burma Still, Burma being a lady, Burma mm-hmm. Still was married a guy named McLean who was an accountant.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while they came out here to live, and then She lived there. He must have died. She lived there. I remember her well. She used to always ride the Pioneer Day Parade. She always rode a side saddle. And then some of her brothers lived out there. They were goofy. Yeah, they were all good. But one guy was goofy enough, he castrated himself, which I consider to be the goofiness. But yeah, and then there are people on that ranch now. A fellow named Tom Foss, whose wife was a descendant of the Stills.
Oh.
She's still alive, but she may know quite a bit of the history.
So there's a lot of the Stills out there.
Well, there are Stills out at Annette. Right. I say their name is Roden.
Yeah, they mentioned that in here.
I don't know. Doreen Roden, who would be a woman a little younger than I, probably. She's had Parkinson's disease for years. If she's still okay, she probably knows quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
And it may be that Judy Foss may know. But her mother was a McLean.
And
her mother was a Still.
Still, right.
Living out there in that family. There was a doctor. The original Still, I think, was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Or what passed for a doctor in those days.
So they've been out there 100 years anyway.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And I say the old stone building that was must have been their hotel, whatever they had there, roadhouse. It's just gutted, but it's still there. I went by there the other day.
Because I talked to a lady that wants to preserve that. She knows I'm into preservation, and she wanted to preserve it. I guess it's just right next to Highway 58, structure.
No, that one would be, if you go by the LaPanzer Ranches. Do you know where LaPanzer Ranches?
On a map, I know where.
Well, it's back about 6 or 7 miles from there. You go off on the Pozo Road.
Okay.
Pozo Road comes into 58 at the LaPanzer Ranch. You go back up there, and the Fosses live back up there. I say maybe 5, 6, 7 miles, something like that. And that's where the old stone building is.
So that was a big deal. Okay. So, I don't know. Does that look? That doesn't have any citation on it or anything on it.
Who knows? Just from the hills, it looks like it could have been a bridge across the San Juan Creek up there, but that's what it looks like.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's not much of a stream. It could have been. I don't. It's a real good picture of that man. I don't know who it is, but somebody just looking at it with a magnifying glass, somebody might know. But that looks like that country out there.
Looks
very much like that.
This has got on the front, it says no irrigation, August 16th, 1915, and then it has some more stuff on the back.
The picture of the my Arroyo Grande Rancho.
Is that corn crops on my Arroyo Grande Ranch?
I suspect that's bean. You see that's bean?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Which are just, you know.
Yeah, and that looks like beans on the
irrigation.
But evidently it was some, that was.
Uh-huh. Well, we know that's Arroyo Grande. That's unlikely that anybody would know who that person was.
Yeah, no, it's just, this is just a bunch of goats or sheep.
Sheep.
And this is the same picture, and this says Steve Daniels, so.
I don't know Steve Daniels. I don't know. You know, they in the Farm Bureau paper, they often publish a picture and invite people to write in.
Yeah.
So, you know, these pictures would probably be the kind of thing they'd like to have.
That they would, yeah. And that looks like a like an oil, you know, where they're making an oil reservoir or something like that.
What do you think that part of, and the tank bottom? Oh, okay, well that is, that's the bottom of the tank.
For an oil tank.
Yeah,
right?
Like you got a picture like
right,
this.
Right, yeah, right, okay.
These are, I guess, I don't know where these are.
I think that's an oil port down there by, on the Sunset Terrace, between, you know, between Avila and Pismo.
That could be. There are a bunch of those, well, you could almost tell that's the inlet there. There's a bunch of tanks, of course, up on the hill back of Morrow, too.
Right, yeah.
They're empty.
Yeah, this is his a refinery at Oil Port, and Oil Port was there on Sunset Terrace.
Well, there were two. There was there was Estero Bay, and there was Estero Bay would be above Morrow.
Yeah.
And they were that oil was stored in those tanks up on the hill above Morrow.
Right. Yeah. And those are still there, I think.
They're still sitting there, empty.
Yeah.
My daughter, one other daughter was interested in buying a piece of land down there. We went up with a piece of land right behind that. It was for sale. We haven't looked at it, but you're looking right from the best building site. You're looking right down into those tanks. And it was very, very ugly. I don't know why it was so repulsively ugly looking down into that thing.
Well, you know, they won't last forever. They'll take them down just like they did.
Well, that's right. They couldn't. There's a piece of property up there, belongs to the same guy that owns that land, the farming land next to the Madonna Plaza Shopping Center. What the hell is his name?
Delidio.
Delidio.
Okay.
Yeah. Delidio has this piece right behind the oil tank.
Oh. And
then he's got about 500 acres. With about a mile or a mile and a half of oceanfront further north.
Uh-huh. The oceanfront. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. But that's worse.
Let's see, we've been through all of these. Okay, now, these are some of the still pictures. Let me see, I've got, in other words, like some of these pictures are, I can write notes on here directly on.
Oh, with Bert and Clara, okay. Now this, Bert Alley lived, again, you know, we looked up and we saw where Highway 58 could
right.
That
uh-huh.
Hill. Right at the top of the hill, you would go head back toward the mountain on something called the Red Hill Road.
Mm-hmm.
Drop down into the canyon there, and that's where Bert Alley lived.
Okay.
There's an alley who lives in Shandon. I mean, if you started down there, there's this Bill Alley, who's the age of my children, lives in Shandon. Very nice fellow. I don't know how much Bill knows about those ancestors,
mm-hmm.
but they were. Bird Alley was his grandfather. Yeah, because his father. Billy Alley's father, Bill, was born up there. I do not ever remember the barn, but they used to do mining up there. So they had a kind of a hydraulic mining thing. I don't think they made much, but I think they raised a family.
Was it gold or cinnabar?
Gold.
Right?
They panned gold. They washed gold out of the creek bottom.
Right. And then they started.
There's some big piles of gravel up there.
In this Navajo?
That's Bert Alley's place, that's where it was. I remember Navajo Canyon, sure.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well,
we used to, I knew all those things.
That's good. What about this as a homestead?
A still, with NF. Okay, that's, right, I told you, that's, you would turn to Chelam,
uh-huh.
go back up in the hill up there.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Probably 10 miles up there, but that's where that is. And it's a Doreen Still Road, and that would be Doreen's probably grandfather, or great-grandfather.
Uh-huh.
She would, and then Doreen's son is Billy Roden, lives out there, and I would think that Doreen would know quite a bit about this.
Uh-huh.
Maybe your son does too, I don't know.
Okay. Or she might like copies of the pictures too.
She well might, I don't know. I say, I used to know her when she was a girl and went to school in Chandler. She's mm-hmm. somewhat younger than I. But she's had, I think it's Parkinson's, for years and years and years.
Okay.
So I don't know what condition she's in. But
yeah.
Her son is very nice. So long. I'm sure they, you know, they might be very interested in this.
This doesn't have any notes on it.
No, it doesn't tell you what that is. What in the world is that?
It looks like it's some sort of a digging.
Somebody would be able to tell you what that is. Yeah, that's the tool for moving earth, large quantities of earth. I would have to think it had something to do with mining. What do you think? You think this is something hanging from up there?
That looks like there's a great big block.
Yeah, I don't know. It's not something that I've ever seen, but.
That's what I was thinking, plaster mining, you know, just, and this is basically a long tom over here.
Well, since you have pictures, still pictures, it might be that, might be from that alley. I don't remember the alleys ever having anything that big.
This doesn't have anything, it's just a...
Yeah, well, I would pitch tail up onto a wagon like that, that's what we used to haul with. And that...
Let's see, that had four animals? Four
yeah,
horses?
Yeah, four.
Okay.
We usually haul hay with two horses. But, you know, that could be around Santa Margarita, Pozo, or La Panza. It's just obviously this area. Sunset of La Panza. I don't think it would be very hard to find where that is.
The silhouette of the hill would probably tell you. Probably look around.
I think that's probably the top of the La Panza grade.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you can find that pretty easy.
That's kind of interesting. I don't know who that guy is.
I don't know. You know, we always had a lot of guys like that. In a nice head stall, a bit. That was in the Western Saddle.
These stirrups, are those, is that pretty routine?
That's pretty standard. Sometimes you have what were called tapadillos, which were leather covered.
Uh-huh.
And because you keep the brush
from coming in there, yeah.
Stretching your feet. Sometimes the tapadillos came down and they had long flaps on the bottom. When they were working cattle, parting cows and calves, just like to shake the flaps out of the calves and it was going back. But it made the saddle awful heavy. I used to have them on my saddle too. It just made the saddles very heavy. They didn't care. They rode big horses. I do not know that fella. But they're sure what they looked like.
Now, you know, that's one of the questions I had. Is there much difference in the livestock between now and what 60, 70, 80 years ago?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Were they more, nowadays is it more of a recreational horse, more of a quarter horse type
of thing? Oh, more different than horses.
Well, the working horse.
You work totally differently now. Well, they have these highly trained horses and they're quite wonderful. They're cutting horses.
Okay.
And what they're trained to do, the horse wants to be able to do it. They want the horses to be very fast, and they want them to, they part out of them. You got 20 animals here, you go in and you move one animal out. He doesn't like me, and he wants to get back. And that horse is supposed to keep the animal out.
Right.
When I was young, these fellows didn't want their horse to. They wanted the horse to reign. They wanted the horse to do what they wanted him to do.
Mm-hmm.
What the horse knew, it's a totally different kind of a horse, and he was very light as you reined him. These horses, they don't expect a guide, but they expect the horse by instinct to do it. It's a wonderful skill. It was equally wonderful when the horse was responsive to the reins of the and the pressure of the
mm-hmm.
legs and all that sort of thing. But we wanted to be able to direct our horse. Now they want the horse to do it itself.
Hmm.
Then people used to rope with a braided rawhide rope. It was maybe 60 to 90 feet long. And the better the cowboy was, the further out he could catch something.
Mm-hmm.
He might catch something 40 feet out in front of his horse going hell-bent. That was a good cowboy. Now they want the horse to be much faster. They want the horse to take them right up alongside of the animal and they rope down.
Right.
Instead of roping out,
right.
They rope down. They rope with a rope about 30 feet long
mm-hmm.
and a much smaller loop.
Mm-hmm.
Rope with a huge loop like people used to use the animal. With these animals, the way it's done now, they run right through it. They rope with a great big loop. Oh, they take up 25 feet of the rope in the loop.
Mm.
And then they rope out to the end of that rope.
Hmm.
And so the horse was totally different. These horses are much, the other horses, well, I don't know, they had more endurance. They liked horses that were more thoroughbred and a lot of endurance. They're big horses.
Mm-hmm.
These horses are more for short bursts of speed.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. if you're a modern kind of roper, you're only going to run. They're going to have that, they're going to be on top of that calf within a couple of leaps.
And they're going to drop their
if you go to the Salinas Rodeo 50, 60 years ago, that wasn't what they did. They roped the animal way out in front of them. The further they roped them, the better they were.
Now, let me see if I understand. You were still trying to do the same thing, cut that animal out from the herd. Now, what you're saying is 70 years ago, it was you that were kind of cutting that out, and you were working the animal, and then once you got the animal set, then you would work, your lasso would be out quite a bit.
I say a typical thing was, supposing you had been working for Miller and Lux.
Uh-huh.
Big cattle, biggest cattle out there around, and the foreman would say, we're going to gather this area today, and we're going to sort out the fat cattle. So they'd have a dozen or 20 cowboys would gather an area. They would hold the cattle in a group, in a circle of cowboys around them, and the foreman would have had, somebody would have led the foreman's cutting horse out there.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't have ridden the horse out there, nor would he have led it himself.
Mm-hmm.
Some flunky would allow it. He would put his saddle on the other horse. He would cut the cattle out that he wanted. Maybe they were pregnant heifers, or maybe they were fat steers, or whatever it was. When he got them out of the herd, another group of cowboys would take them and hold them in a separate group.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe in the evening they would move them where they were going to move them. And the foreman prided himself on being able to do this by himself.
Oh.
He wanted, but I've heard these guys telling some guy, you get after it. If I can't cut this animal out, I'll let you know and you can do it.
Okay.
As long as I cut him out, your job is to hold the herd.
So that they don't stampede or
well,
something like that.
Well, pride.
Oh, I see.
I don't need Jesus.
Okay.
Here now.
You know,
right here.
If you can cut him out, you're the foreman, so to speak.
When we had the big ranch in Oregon, the horses all came in, and the horse wrangler brought the horses in the morning. They were trained. He had made a corral. He had stakes about 2 feet long with a ring in it.
Yeah.
And he'd grown the stakes in the ground. He had a was only about that high. The horse could all stood with their heads out. Each cowboy, there were 12 to 15 cowboys, each cowboy told the foreman what horse he wanted. And the foreman rode. Nobody else rode the horse. He didn't whirl the rope. Overhand. He caught the horse, and the horse came out. And when they branded, they held the cattle, usually in a corner of the field, and the foreman, one other guy, would rope the calves by the hind feet, drag them out, and then the ground crew grabbed them and took the rope off the guy. And if the guy that was in there doing the roping with the foreman, if he missed a few, the foreman would say, you come and do it. Mm-hmm. He didn't count to say anything mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. So the horses were trained for very specific things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Totally different now than it used to be. But these horses are just as wonderful as any horses that ever worked.
So let's see. Again, that's the same old thing.
Yeah. I say, look, it could be. It's in these foothills someplace. Yeah. I don't know where.
And then here's a pretty scene on the river in Pozo.
Okay. Yeah. Well. Sure. The Salinas runs, you know, it's about a mile to the east, to the west of Pozo. That's a great picture. I don't know. The fellow that works on it, John Arnold, probably undoubtedly tell you where that was. Mm-hmm. But you can see the cattle look quite different. Yeah, that's a keen mm-hmm. picture.
Let's see, that goes here. Then, let's see, this. These people, oh, I guess that's Mrs. Still, I guess is R.N. Still.
Maryville, Missouri, born in New Kent County, Virginia, 15th of May, if we don't know this one. Huh.
So that well,
I don't know whether the people in the family, there's plenty of Stills around, I would, you know, maybe they've never seen these pictures. Uh-huh. I would think they'd be fascinated by them.
Okay.
Now, I don't know who Mrs. R.M. Still was, but certainly Doreen Roden would know.
Okay.
And if Doreen, let's see, if she's not mentally up to it anymore, her son or daughter might know.
Uh-huh.
Who else? The other person who would know it would be Judy Foss, who was a Still. There are lots of others, I'm sure, but I just don't happen to know them.
Because this, it would seem like, from the dress and stuff like that, is probably before in 1800s, I mean, late 1800s.
Oh, sure. Well, she was born.
She was born in
1831.
So that's.
And she was still in Missouri at the time this picture was taken.
Or she was home on a visit. But anyway, at this point, she's 70 years old, so it's...
Yeah, I think it's a long track. Yeah, that's a great picture.
Yeah. This is the guarantee phone.
This is E.M. Still. Gosh, you know, those pictures were 3.5 in those days.
Well, this is probably the antique, I think.
Oh.
Maybe, I think that's... The guy that was pricing them, that yeah. Adam was.
Well,
pricing.
Anyway, I'm sure that either of those ladies that I mentioned would be able to tell you who these people were, mm-hmm. what relation they were, and where they came. They would clearly know.
Okay. All right.
What you might, you know, if you are going to pursue it, you might call and talk to Bill Roden.
Uh-huh.
Bill Roden Sr. is married to Doreen Still.
Okay.
And their son lives out on the ranch, and they're out there and in there.
Okay. Well,
and I would think if you called in and told them that you had a bunch of old pictures, would they be interested in going over them with you? They well might.
Yeah.
Or you could call.
Or we could offer copies if he would
do
that.
Sure.
He'd offer copies. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they're very nice people.
Okay.
And I think otherwise you could call Tom Foss. I don't know Judy, really. I haven't seen her for many years.
Probably the thing is to call, say, Tom, and find out who in the family is interested in genealogy and stuff like that,
yeah.
And then let let that decide.
I guess I would be inclined to start with Mill Road.
Okay.
Would be the place to start.
Okay.
Because between Mrs. Roden and Mrs. Foss, they would reveal about these deals. Then I'll tell you who else. I think he's still alive. McLean. There's a McLean in Paso Robles who's written a number of books.
Oh, okay.
You get them in the, I don't know, you've seen, you get them in the bookstores that have...
at the museums and stuff like that, historical.
I've forgotten which one it is. Duncan or Oather. Anyway, there's a McLean around, and he really is up on the history because he's written a lot about it.
Okay.
And he would be somebody you ought to talk to. I don't think
Steve,
I may have his book, I'll look.
Steve Daniels. That's the one that we didn't know.
Don't know Steve Daniels.
And then this is Oather or something like that.
Oather. That's Oather McLean.
Oh.
I believe that would be Oather McLean.
Let me write that on the back there.
Yeah, I think that, and there may have been an Oather still, but Oather McLean may have been, but there was an Oather McLean, and he would have been a great uncle of Judy Foss.
Okay.
He would be related closer to these, to the LaPenza stills, than he would be to the Annette stills.
You say to LaPenza, huh?
Yeah, I think that's okay. More like,
okay. And that's a baby picture. So.
Yeah.
And now this is J.H. Crafts at the Old Mines, or?
At the Navajo.
Yeah.
Well.
1910.
Well, again, see, they did a lot of mining out there about that time. There was a kind of a minor gold boom out there. Louis Sensteiner told me he never remembered them bringing in much gold. Mostly boom, not much gold. But there were a lot of people out there in those canyons. LaPenza Canyon, next two or three canyons down. And the Navajo Canyon, which was apparently the only one left. They took some gold out there.
Uh-huh.
But that, there'd be nobody alive who would ever have seen any of this. I've ridden horseback through most of that country. I've never seen anything like it. But
it looks just like a little shack or
something like that. Yeah, sure. Well, it's the J.F. Crafts of the Old Mine Cabin. Well, I don't know. I don't know who would know about that, unless that one McLean. Perhaps he may know more than anybody.
Because
he's researched it. He's written some books about the Indians out there and the Painted Rock. And he's the local historian. I'm glad I found him.
Okay.
I'll look and see if I have his books.
I can follow, I'll go up to Pacific, Paso Robles Historical Society. Maud Fotheringham?
Well, the Fotheringhams, I think, were out on the Carissa. I'm not sure. I never knew them, but I know that there was a name that I remember. I just remember hearing the name. I don't remember.
Okay.
I did not know anything about them, but
they were out.
That's a local name.
Let's see.
Definitely a local name.
That's in Carissa.
Yeah, it's that area someplace.
This one right here is this is again Oather, so that may be Oather.
Yeah, well, I'd say I know that's Judy Foss's great uncle or something of that nature.
Okay.
Her grandmother, I suspected of being her grandmother's brother. So she'd be a good source for it.
Okay. Let's see there, we've got this. And let's see, this is Edith Still.
Oh, that's a great picture. I don't know who Edith Still was, but again...
Whether she was which...
I don't know, Edith. Well, I suspect that she belongs to the Annette Still.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of any... You know, the old married people around. I can't think of any Edith out there.
I think I'm going to check this back against that other picture where we've got a house in it.
This is Edith Still also.
I wonder if this is this house.
Well, it surely looks like it does. You can't see the top, but it's got the same kind of fence. Yeah, I guess that's either Still, sure.
Yeah, okay. Well, that.
Yeah, I think these can be, you can find out about these people.
And there's Mentally Still.
Yeah.
And a cult chief? What would a cult chief be? Or is that the cult, the chief, the names of the cult?
I think that's the cult they call chief.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, he's got that cult, he has front leg there, he's putting them down. Yeah.
Okay. And Maddie Rellers?
Don't know.
Looks like R-E-L-L-E-R-S.
Sellers. I believe it's Sellers.
Sellers?
There's more likely to be Sellers.
And that's...
Well, there was a Sellers lived up on the Avenals. Whether this is it, I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't know about the name. Might have been Sellers' daughter. The family lived up there on the lower end of the Avenel, just after you go in the ranch.
Okay.
And I think you'll probably find that is Sellers.
Okay. And then this one right here is Clarence Percy Still, 6 months old, and the picture is for Uncle Will, evidently.
Well, let's see.
That's kind of interesting because the Arnold, it's a studio in San Luis.
Yes, yes. Well, of course, the historical, somebody in the Historical Society would know about that. But, those people can be identified.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be a big problem. We will look and see if I have Still's book from the Indians.
McLean's book.
Yeah. If not, they surely have them in the historical. They're for sale in the bookstore.
And if Paso has some of these things.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Mark Paul Patton just got a whole bunch of these things in a passel of pictures. And he didn't want to lose them, and so he bought the whole kit and caboodle of them. And so he didn't have them. He's over in Las Vegas now, so he didn't have any chance to look these things up. But I can follow it up.
Yeah, well, I think that... let me look for the kit. I have the claims work in there.
Okay, well... Let me just stop this and then we'll...
Mrs. R.C. Heaton came up there one time when my mother-in-law was up there, and she said she had taught briefly at that school when she was a girl, and she thought she showed my mother-in-law where she thought it was, and it was several miles from the house.
From?
It was up in there. Then the American school...
Was it, I mean, so to speak, downriver? I mean,
from Poso.
It was more towards Pozo.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure, it was a couple of miles towards Pozo. I think it was probably where the ranch house is. And the American school was somewhere in the general vicinity of where our locked gate is, I think.
Okay.
I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
Then, there were a lot of schools. There was a school in Park Hill, the El Dorado School. There was one about... 3 or 4 miles down the river from Poso, the new school.
Now that would have been, okay, there is a school there in Poso.
The old Poso that, school was up on the hill.
Yeah.
Abandoned building up there.
Right.
That was the Poso school.
Okay.
Then there was, they moved it. They moved it about 3 miles away then, before they abandoned it.
And then, now, you mentioned that there were something like 60 homesteaders, right? I mean, over a period of time from probably 1890
to... Well, there must have been a time when there were quite a lot of them there at once because they had a school and a post office.
Okay.
At the ranch house.
Okay.
So, yeah, there were a total of about 60 homesteaders, but there were also other people up there who were... names do not appear on the record, because there were some people who were school trustees who were not landowners.
Right. Okay.
And who else? I don't know.
Now, the 60 families, were they scattered from one end of the Avenellis ranch up closer by Douglas Creek or...
They had to live on their homestead.
Okay. So...
In order to move up on your homestead, you had to live on it.
And so their kids weren't going to go long distances to school.
Oh, I imagine they'd go...
3 or 4 miles.
3 or 4 miles, 5 or 6
right.
miles. They used to have a school about Alliance, was about halfway between here and Shandon. The kids... The boy whose parents were on this ranch, he was 7 miles down, he rode a horse.
Okay.
Rain or shine, and when the San Juan Creek was up, why, somebody would be down and watch him cross the creek to be sure he was okay. He had a little pacing horse, and he'd get down in about 40 minutes. Then when he was about 10 years old, his sister went to school, was going to go to school, so he drove the Model T there. Somebody would start the car up for him in the morning, and he'd drive down, and then, the teacher had maybe 8 or 10 kids there, and so they came horseback, and some in wagons, and some in cars, and she'd have to see that the cars got started in the afternoon, or the horses got bridled, or whatever.
This is Alliance school, huh?
No, I was Alliance.
Okay. And she probably had maybe 15 kids total?
At most.
Or something like that?
Mostly it was 8 or 9, I think, 10. I can remember that when that school was operating.
So this was operating as late as, what, the 20s maybe?
Yeah, probably closed in about 1930.
Okay. Now, where were you living? Where your parents were living down there, right across the street, right?
No, we lived up in Hillsboro.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
So, in other words,
I never lived here when I was going to school.
When you were a child,
no,
I mean, this wasn't a ranch existence for you.
We always came down on vacation.
But it was a vacation, that type of thing. You lived in Hillsboro, and you schooled.
My father came down every month for a week, went to all the ranches.
I see.
We had 3 ranches then, and rented some others. So he came down every month for a week. And then my mother and father would come down in the spring and spend a couple of months. And you'd
come down too?
Well, no, we'd stay. A grandmother or somebody would come down and stay with us.
Or you would be.
We were still going to school.
When you got out of school, then you would come down and join mom and dad.
By the time we were in high school, and my brother and I would come down for the summer.
Now, did you then, it was expected of you that you would be ranch hands then, huh?
Yeah, sure, we're supposed to.
I mean, it was not just fun, but I mean,
if there was any work to do, we were supposed to do it.
Yeah, right.
That was the depths of the Depression.
Right.
There wasn't any free money running around very far.
Well, it was more or less treated as your summer employment. You weren't coming down here and skylarking your death.
It was possible to do it, you see, because each ranch had a cook.
Right.
So there was always a place where you got fed.
Right.
Yeah. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been so easy.
So then, so you went through grammar school and high school in Hillsboro.
I didn't have a high school in Hillsboro then. I went to grammar school. I went to high school in Burlingame.
Oh, okay. And then you completed?
Then I went to Berkeley.
Okay, and then did you go to Berkeley?
Yeah.
Okay, then you switched allegiances, huh, later on?
Well, my kids all went to Stanford, that's all.
Okay, well, that's... So the ranch experience was something that was, it wasn't, you didn't, you know, trudge four hours through the snow to go to school and stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, the boy that lived down here, he rode 7 miles to school. That was a pretty good stint.
Right.
It was cold in the winter, you know.
How many miles?
It was 7 miles.
Oh, 7 miles. Okay.
Yeah, still. And he did that for probably 4 years, and then when his sister went to school, they didn't want her to ride that far, so they say he was 10, I think. And let him take the Model T.
Now, was that your dad's head hand at this ranch?
It was ranch foreman.
Okay. Because you wouldn't have, the other people that were working wouldn't have had.
They were all single, other than that, they were all single men.
Okay.
Yeah, they lived in a bunkhouse, which was just, sometimes in these, that particular bunkhouse, there were 3 or 4 individual rooms. Those were for the permanent guys. And then the other guys in the summer, if it was raining or something, they might all slept in the living room. Otherwise, they slept out under the trees.
Uh-huh.
But the food was very, very good.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
People wouldn't stay when the food wasn't good.
Was that a characteristic of, a ranch was known not by its crops, but by its food?
Huh? Right. That's a good cook.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And they had the Lepanzer Ranch, they had a cook, and the Admiral had a cook, and the Comati had one. All the ranches had cooks.
Huh.
Very early days, long before I remember it, the cooks were often Chinese men.
Uh-huh.
But then when I remember it, they were mostly, they were all women.
Uh-huh.
Chilam Ranch had a man cook, if I remember.
And this was probably a couple, or was it just a single woman?
Well, both. It was better if it was a couple.
Uh-huh.
People were happier.
Yeah, and then he might have been some sort of a ranch
hand, too. He was usually referred to as a char man.
Uh-huh.
We always had, because it was a long way to town, you had chickens, and milk cows, and pigs, sometimes turkeys. And he took care of them, he took care of the garden. And
so he was doing the domestic equivalent of cooking.
He did the chores.
Yeah, okay.
And then one of his jobs always was to bring in the firewood.
Uh-huh.
The cooks were always beefing and bitching about the firewood. It was too big or too small or too green. So it was much better. I always thought better if it was her husband who brought in the firewood.
Right, yeah.
And they didn't hear about it.
Okay.
You give him hell.
Nice. And this was the pattern throughout all
the ranches had it, yeah.
Okay.
Sure. All of
them. And so then your dad, when he was responsible, cooked up the deal with Sinton Brown.
Yeah.
Was that as a consequence of him seeing the feedlot business was new? Did he see that started in Speckles, and then say, hey, you know, we could do that feedlot down here.
The Union Sugar Company factory was closed down. They closed down in, I think, 1927.
Uh-huh.
They opened around 1899, closed about 1927. The price of everything was, of course, terrible. change the subject a little bit. When you wanted to sell cattle on a ranch, say here in the Avenel, you had two choices. You could try to get a buyer from the meatpacking plant to come up and look at them.
Okay.
But he had to get here, he had to get on the train, come to Santa Margarita or Paso Robles, somebody met him, took him out, showed him. By the time he got here, you had your cattle up for him to look at for a week or two. They were starting to eat all the grass up in the field. He had you at his mercy. The other thing you could do is drive them to the railroad, put them on the train, and ship them to stockyards. You tried to get them to the stockyards on a Saturday night or Sunday morning, and then they'd have feed and water. And then the buyers descended on the stockyards. There were 36 meatpacking plants in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So there was competition there.
Mm-hmm.
There were probably five in San Francisco. So there was competition there. On the other hand, all the buyers knew that it was costing the owner of those cattle money to keep them in the stockyards.
Mm-hmm.
They had a you shipped them to a commission agent,
mm-hmm.
who had a group of corrals. Each commission man had corrals.
Mm-hmm.
You shipped them to whoever you favored. And then he had to charge you for feed, water, and care, and whatever else.
So you would say you and a number of other ranchers would get your cattle to, say, Paso, where the commission was?
We did it individually. We didn't merge our cattle with anybody else's. Somebody might have.
Yeah. But I mean, there were other ranches doing the same thing you were doing.
Sure, we were coming into Los Angeles closely. And of course, these guys knew that if they didn't bid on the cattle too strong on Monday or Tuesday, by Wednesday, you'd be calling the commission man and urging him to get those cattle sold.
Right.
Eating me out of house and home here.
Right.
Now, interestingly, in Europe, all through the Middle Ages, the big market, the big city in Europe was Paris. And there would be people like commission. There would be a guy, you or I, would start out from Paris, and we'd on foot, of course, and we would go into Poland and Ukraine and other places like that, and we'd buy cattle, and we'd get a little bunch together, maybe 10 cattle or 12 cattle. We drive them to Paris, and on the outskirts of Paris was a stockyard, and corrals, and commission men, and these guys who had assembled these cattle would put them in Monsieur somebody or other's pens, and the retail butchers of Paris came out every morning, and they had the refrigeration.
Right.
They would come out every morning, and they'd buy an animal or two animals, they butcher them right there, load the meat on their wagons, carts, take them down to their butcher shop. Now,
just like you would a chicken. I mean, you know, it's the same sort of
thing. In Paso Robles, there was a meat packing plant, and the people who owned the meat packing plant, the Bryans, also had a retail butcher shop, and then they supplied other retail butcher shops. They killed each day the animal. They killed a sheep, two sheep, and a pig, and a couple of cows, or whatever they thought they could sell. They had no refrigeration.
Right.
They had a couple of fans later on, originally nothing. Then they had some fans powered in some manner by a gasoline engine in the back, and then some belts that came with it.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to create a little coolness in the summertime.
But that was it.
But every morning, George Bryan and his crew went over there, the retail butchers, and they butchered what they needed for the day, loaded it on a wagon. It was on this side of the river. They hauled it across the river to their retail butcher shop and delivered pieces of sides or whatever it was to whoever had ordered them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the way. So it was very similar to what had been done for 500 years.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Then it only got to, but you know, it was a long. It was. You were so. My father had thought that you would, if you only had a feedlot, put the cattle in there, then it wouldn't be so crucial that you didn't have to ship them to the stockyards anyway. A pack of buyers came out
in the...
And pretty soon there were, we had one, the Fieldings had one, there was some at Bakersfield, scattered about as the buyer. The Packard buyers would usually go to the Los Angeles stockyards and buy cattle on Monday and Tuesday. And then by Wednesday, they would be fanning out. And you would know that the buyers would be by your place maybe every Thursday or whatever it was. And that was the way you differed with them on the cattle.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so crucial whether you sold them this week or not, yet you couldn't keep them too long.
How many times a month did a typical ranch like this go to market? I mean, obviously you didn't do it.
Once or twice a year.
Okay, so that was, and were these staggered kind of, because?
They were when the grass dried.
Okay.
So that in itself was a bum deal. Everybody had to sell the cattle at once.
Okay, that's what I'm wondering about.
Sure.
In other words, you've got a cattle glut, and so if you can get to market faster.
Or if you can put them in a feedlot and string it out.
Right.
So that, thinner cattle that you put in would take a little longer, so you would be selling your cattle out of the feedlot maybe over a period of five
right.
or 6 weeks, instead of all of a sudden you had to have them all in the stockyard the same day.
So the feedlot business, I mean, that came about as a means to kind of moderate the market.
Well, for my father, somebody was going to have the feedlot there, and he, when they started the sugar factory up again in 1933, I guess, he knew some people who were big stockholders in the company, and they got him the contract.
Okay.
Then he had to find a partner, and he found Howard Brown,
uh-huh.
who was somebody whose his family and my father's family had known one another since the 1860s.
Uh-huh. Was he from the peninsula?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think he had most recently been up in the San Joaquin Delta, but yeah, he came from San Francisco.
And so then
he was somebody my father.
Was that their only feedlot?
Yeah,
or did they
that was it. That was it.
And the
later on we owned Howard liked to own cattle to come into the feedlot. And so he might contract cattle to be delivered in 2 months or 3 months or 6 months,
uh-huh.
scattered. They'd have cattle scattered about to come in, and then as soon as they got in the feedlot, then you tried to sell them. Then you want to own them all.
Right.
And you tried to sell them in the meat packers. He regularly, the big packer in San Francisco, James Allen and Sons, and we normally had maybe 6 to 10,000 cattle that belonged to James Allen. They happened to like to own a lot of cattle.
Uh-huh.
So you tried, when you couldn't sell them, then you had to own them, because you had to keep the feedlot going.
But you didn't want to own any more than you had to. But if you had to own them, then you had a place to feed them, too. You weren't quite at the mercy. So now, was this innovative as far as feeding the beet pulp to the cats?
People had been feeding beet pulp. I presume as long as they had been making beet sugar.
Okay.
Beet sugar was a big crop in Europe.
Right.
So the technology came from Germany and Sweden.
Okay.
If I remember, maybe also France.
Uh-huh.
Those were big. If you raise more calories, food value per acre with sugar beets than any other crop.
Uh-huh.
So this has been a major crop for I don't know how long, maybe hundreds of years.
Uh-huh.
But you had to do something with the pulp. And before it was dehydrated, they used to pump it into big pit silos. Great thing, they're hell.
Right.
Tremendous things. And it fermented there. And it smelled, you had to be quite a distance from town because people didn't like it.
Yeah.
As Santa Maria grew in that direction, it would have become impossible.
Yeah.
And then they put it into the soil and they pumped it in with water. So it was wet, very wet.
Slurry.
Went into the silo had drains in the bottom, slots on them, and the water drained out, and it was a ditch clear to the ocean. Probably about 6 miles of ditch down in the ocean, and to keep that clear of weeds. And that smelled pretty bad.
And then this was, I mean, shoveled out to the animals at a certain.
This particular feedlot. We took over a feedlot that was falling to ruins down there, because there'd been a feedlot there since 1900, but it had been closed down for 5 years and everything was in disrepair. But they had had, and we kept a little narrow gauge railroad. Little cars, a little engine like a mine engine would be, and the tracks went into the silos, and they backed this at switching deals, and they backed these cars in. Originally, had Filipino labor shoveled the people into the cars, and then they also filled. They had a mill, and they put cars with grain and. They had cars with hay and whatever else they mixed. And then when they got the train loaded, then the laborers got on the train and the train go chugging down the tracks. There were pens on both sides of the tracks.
Uh-huh.
And then they guys shoveled the stuff off again.
Yeah.
Then later on, we got a mechanical shovel to load with. You loaded the grain and stuff by gravity, but you still had to shovel it off. So I had people shovel it off.
Well, what changed? Did there something happen in the sugar market? Because Union Sugar, they closed, what, in around 60 or something, I thought?
Something like that. Yes. For a long time, it was national policy